Colorado legislature just ended its devastating 2024 session. The winners were, of course, progressives and special interests, with taxpayers again losing. But the super minority Republicans have a few things they can call success. Marianne Goodland from the Gazette newspapers breaks it down for us. I'm John Caldera. This is the audio version of our television show, Devil's Advocate. Watch that show by going to YouTube and looking for IITV. That's Independence Institute TV. Please subscribe and share this podcast. Enjoy. So we're recording this just mere hours after the end of the legislative session. Poor Marianne Goodland has been there for the whole thing. So Marianne, just how tired are you?
Tired, but not as much as I was after the end of last year's session.
Really? Why is that?
Last year's session, the stress of all the animosity that went on in the chambers, in the House in particular, it didn't just take a lot out of lawmakers and staff and the lobbyists. It took a lot out of the press, too. That was,
so
this
was
year
there,
was better.
Was there better communication between R&Ds and Rs and Rs and D's and D's?
Absolutely. It's a 180-degree difference from where we were at the end of the session last year.
What do you think made the difference?
The Republicans are being listened to. That is the difference. When you have ideas about major policy positions, there's no monopoly on who's got the best ideas. Everybody should have a voice at the table. So this year, you saw Republican input on some of the biggest policy areas that came out of this legislative session. You don't see that. You sure didn't see it last year. I actually did a story about this probably about 2 months ago called A Tale of Two Legislatures, where I was beginning to see with some of the bills a lean toward bipartisanship. And it wasn't on really huge public policy issues, but it was growing. You could see things changing.
Why would they change? If you have a supermajority superpower in nearly both houses, why not just keep flexing it? What do you think made the Democrats start to listen a bit more? Was it HH going down in flames?
Absolutely, absolutely. HH played a big role in that. Then you had the special session that followed not long afterwards. And while Republicans didn't like the solutions on property taxes that came out, they had major input on the one thing that, as it turns out, really mattered, and that was the Property Tax Commission.
All right, so let me do it from my point of view here first. I am amazed. Now, keep in mind, when I was in high school, I didn't start a term paper until the day before it was due.
Right.
Obviously, that lifestyle has bubbled into the legislature completely fully. It was, 300 bills that they still had to go through with just a few days left?
About 260, yeah.
All right. I mean, you have 120 days, and you wait till the last minute to not only get a huge bulk of them done, but some of the most important ones, including property tax, including Tabor refunds, including a lot of the gun control issues, are waiting to the very last second when you had 4 months to bring these things out to the public. So let me ask you a couple ways. One, I think it's just terrible discipline that leadership is not doing their job well. But then I wonder, wait a minute, maybe it's political that when you drop the property tax bill with 3 days left in the session, there's not a lot of time for special interests or other people other than the people who are in the closed room to have much impact on it. So is it done on purpose or is it just bad management?
I'm not even sure I'd go with either one of them. I want to go back to the Property Tax Commission. The difference between HH and the property tax bill this year, it comes down to one thing, and that's vetting the ideas. You didn't have that with HH. You had a bill that dropped a couple of days before the end of the session. Republicans never got a chance to see it beforehand. It turned into an absolute cluster that resulted in the Republicans walking out because they refused to vote on something that they had no input on. That is not what happened this year. The property tax bill was bipartisan, which, you know, is astonishing for one, but you also had a commission that went around the state for months getting ideas from people. Now, not all of those ideas made it into this bill, but this was done a whole lot more publicly. And that gives the public, those who are really, really interested, maybe it's only the political class, but it gave people an opportunity to see these ideas that were being floated out there.
I would say, let's stop there for a second. I think it really is the political class, that until it is introduced as a bill, that the average citizen, that I can go and pull up online and go, what is this? And I can read it and see it. I know it might have been bounced around, but I remember my days at RTD, they would do these wonderful major investment studies, and they'd go out and have public outreach. Well, the only people who came to these public outreach things were the people who were in love with choo-choo trains and wanted a tax increase, because the silent majority are too busy with their lives to do that. Mm. And so from my point of view, it seemed as though they waited to the last minute, which they obviously did, to drop the bill. So are you telling me it took a year and 116 days to actually hammer it all out? That doesn't seem real.
Was an earlier version of the property tax bill that came out about 10 days. It never got introduced, but came out about 10 days before the session ended. And the sponsor, Chris Hansen, who was also the sponsor on the bill, floated it around so everybody could get a look at it. Lawmakers primarily could get a look at it. The Property Tax Commission could get a look at it. Didn't go over well with the Property Tax Commission, so it was back to the drawing board. So in that sense, yeah, this was rushed because they had to rewrite and think about different ways of addressing the problem in between 10 days before the session was over with and the 3 days in which the bill had time to get through the process.
Quinn, let's take that bill. So we now have a new property tax bill. It's heading to the governor. Mm-hmm. By the time this airs, could well be signed.
Could be.
What exactly does it do?
Okay. It does a number of different things. And I do find this kind of interesting. It's taken me a while to kind of get my arms around exactly
property
what
tax
really
is not an easy thing to understand. It's not. It is tricky and complicated. The more you get into it, the more complicated it seems.
I'm going to back up a little bit to the property tax bill that passed last year, not the HH portion, but the other part of that bill, which did reduce temporarily homeowners, and this was only for homeowners, the assessment rates for homeowners.
And from what to what? I'm trying to recall. From high to just a little less than high, but it was still a massive increase.
Yeah, you still had your property taxes still went up. They just didn't go up as much. Which is the thing that when they talk about property tax cuts, it's not really a cut in your
taxes.
It's a
cut to an amazing increase.
Yeah.
I don't know about yours. My property tax went up nearly 40%.
Mine wasn't quite that bad, but it went up enough for me to
take notice. And if Gallagher were still in effect, it wouldn't have gone up much at all.
Probably not. And the legislature has been under the gun now ever since the Gallagher repeal in 2020 to come up with something.
So it's only taken them 4 years. Of course.
Yeah, of course.
Government work.
But keep in mind, you had this temporary property tax reduction that was going to expire this year. So what they came up with was a reduction in the homeowner's assessment rate, and I want to say it's 6.7%.
6.7.
I think from 6.95-ish, or maybe a little over 7. I'm too tired to remember numbers right now. But so they're going that is a reduction that just basically maintains the property tax reduction that was in last year's bill. The big difference here, there's actually a number of big differences. You also, it's what it does for commercial building owners, which the previous property tax didn't even touch it. Commercial building owners were left to hang out to dry.
Right.
This one actually has a reduction in the assessment rate for them as well.
If I remember, it goes from 29%. Down to
25,
but it takes 3 years to step down.
Takes 3 years. And that was a big part.
I learned that by reading somebody's article in the Gazette.
She might have gotten it right.
She might have gotten it right that time.
Isn't that great? The step down in the commercial rate was what was really the sort of last sticking point in the bill. Negotiations with Colorado Concern, that was a big issue for them. And there was negotiations that went on yesterday and went on pretty much all day yesterday, which is why the property tax bill was one of the last things to pass. talking to
because it makes sense that the most important bill should be left to the very last hour, the very last day, when every legislator is so harangued and tired they cannot think straight, because that's how you want to run a government.
But those negotiations failed. What they wanted was for Colorado Concern to sign off on support for Senate Bill 233. There had been rumors, weird rumors floating around the building ever since its introduction that, yes, they did back it, and they came back and said, no, we negotiated on it, but we're not there yet. So,
and for those who don't know, Colorado Concern is a strange organization in that it's not, it bills itself as a business organization. No, it's actually a business owners organization.
It's a business owners organization.
So you have a
bunch of
CEOs and owners, all of whom have very different feelings about different things. And so their policy missions at Colorado Concern is completely schizophrenic, depending on which CEOs seem to be in charge at the time.
Yeah.
It's not like, you know, if you're going to the State Shooting Association, they're anti-gun all the time. If you go to the Colorado Union of Taxpayers, they're anti-tax all the time. Concern, you never know. It depends on what the CEOs ate for lunch.
It does. They're all over the map sometimes. It's sort of interesting to watch them for that reason. But if the bill were going to go back to that 2-year step down, mm-hmm, for the commercial assessment rates, they were hoping that would be enough to get Colorado Concern to sign on. That never happened. And the other thing they wanted was for Colorado Concern to back off on support for Initiative 50 and 108 should it make the ballot. No, it wasn't going to happen. And so they had to finally call it quits. They put a repeal on Senate Bill 233 that I thought was really, really interesting. If 50 and 108, either or both, pass, 233 goes into the wastebasket.
So that leads the question, 50 and 108, these are the two initiatives that Colorado Concern is working on. They're very different. 50 takes all the aggregate of all the property taxes, puts them all in one big pile and says that cannot be more than
4%. Correct.
It's a pretty unwieldy proposal, and you're asking the legislature to then make all the rules on who gets cut and who gets to have more taxes and who gets low. It is Pandora's box.
And
108, however, if I've got this right, really focuses in on those assessment rates. And it says that for commercial properties, it goes from, let me see if I got this right, from 29 down to 25%.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And for residential, from the 6, almost 7%, down to 5.7%.
A much lower rate.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that's what lawmakers were trying to get Colorado Concern to back off of, and it didn't happen. So they decided they had to go for it.
Why didn't they go for it?
You'd have to ask them that. I honestly don't know.
They must have a sense that they have a real chance of lowering the assessment rates lower.
Yeah.
And when you think about it, from their point of view, if it's just commercial stuff they're talking about, the only thing they win with 108 is that they get to their assessment rate sooner.
Sooner.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's really about residential rates that make a bigger impact.
This fight is going to be about residential rates, because that's the issue that everybody sits around their kitchen table and worries about.
So we're going to have to see if they're going to put those things on the ballot.
Correct.
If they make it on the ballot, if they keep it on the ballot, and if one or both of those passes, then what was passed this year goes away.
That's right.
I wouldn't mind a lower assessment rate. What was passed?
I don't think anybody would.
Nobody? I bet there's a whole bunch of legislators and county governments that would.
Local governments are nervous about all of this.
Right.
They're nervous because there's the backfill, which is the money the state would pay to cover any lost revenue. The backfill is not there in 50 or 108, which means that local governments could take a pretty big hit. The state budget would also take a pretty big hit, according to the folks who are opposed to these measures, something to the tune of $3 billion. And they worry about the impact on school funding. Now, I had a very short email exchange with Michael Fields from Advance a couple of days ago, and I said, well, what about that? What about these concerns that this is going to be a big hit on education. And his response was basically, it's a matter of priorities. If you think education is important, cut something else, and then you can fund education. I mean, that was kind of the
gist. And why this is important is that the backfill comes from the state.
Yes, it does.
So the state is fine cutting assessment rates for all the 5,000 governments except school districts.
Right.
Because if they cut assessment rates for school districts, it might come out of their wallet.
It'll come out of the state education.
It's all our
fund.
Wallet,
yeah.
But yeah.
It's taxpayer money, no matter which way you slice it.
Again, I'm just so frustrated, angry, that something this big takes 4 years for them to bring forward something, and they do it on the very last day possible. It takes 3 days to get something through the legislature, so they drop it 3 days before the end of the legislative session. I just find it so dismissive. I find it arrogant. I find it just awful government.
No, this bill got almost no testimony whatsoever. People, you know, it dropped so fast, it moved through committee so fast that it didn't give people an opportunity to. And as you said, property taxes is such an incredibly complex issue. You need time to look through this. How does this work? Is this really going to be a savings? You know, how is this being paid for? Which we still don't have a good answer for.
Speaking of that, let's switch over to what I think was the other big thing that got very little coverage because it wasn't any time. It was this, what are we doing with our Tabor refunds, which are growing sky high, and I would like them back. And so the traditional trick that the legislature uses is when the excess revenue goes up too high, they just decide to call a bunch of these things fees and pull it into a different bucket. So the government pot still continues to grow, but our refunds go down. So tell me if I've got this right. There was a argument on how to refund it.
Mm-hmm.
And a huge fee increase.
I think we're talking about two different bills, maybe.
Yeah, but weren't they tied together a little bit? First, let's talk about Tabor refunds.
Okay.
What did they pass?
This to me, of all the bills in the session, this was one of the most interesting. I love watching what lawmakers want to do with Tabor surplus money. We had somewhere between 50 and 100 bills that would tap the Tabor surplus to pay for everything, you know, everything under the sun. It was a family income tax credit that the last time I looked was a $655 million hit to the Tabor surplus. You had another one for care workers, which could be almost anyone, but because the definition on this bill was a bit loose, that started out at $256 million. And the amount that we had available for Tabor refunds in this cycle is about $2 billion. So those two bills,
takes away half of it.
Would eat up half of it almost right off the bat. Now, they modified the fiscal note on the care worker bill, and that's now down under $100 million. That's all. But
and that's nothing.
Republicans and Democrats this year saw tax credits as the golden goose that would pay for all their programs. And it wasn't just the Democrats. Right, so everybody was going after
this.
Can
I bring you back to yesteryear? When there was a candidate named Jared Polis who said, I am going to lower taxes permanently, not just temporarily. I want a permanent income tax cut in Colorado, and I'm going to pay for that by getting rid of special interest tax breaks.
That's right.
Well, a study we did at Independence showed the obvious. He has put in more special interest tax breaks than pretty much any governor. And they're getting larger and larger and larger. Our tax refunds are getting smaller. The opportunity to permanently lower the income tax rate is going away because he lied. Well, I love that dismissive look. Could you do that again? There we go.
Well, what we got this year with the Tabor refund bill was we got that tax cut that goes from 4.4, the income tax reduction. It goes from 4.4 to 4.25%, but there's caveats attached to it. And it is not necessarily permanent. This gave Republicans a very, very big win. That's all they could talk about today or Thursday on the press conferences that they hold the day after session. that income tax cut was like the cherry on the sundae for them. It also brings back a tax cut. This is also part of bringing back a way of refunding Tabor money. It restarts some other mechanisms that we've had in the past that never got to fruition, this tax cut, this income tax rate cut being one of them. And then they did some tweaking with the six-tiered sales tax refund. So creating basically a fourth mechanism for refunding taxes. And the reason that the Democrats went along with this, because you couldn't find a Democrat in the building that would say, sure, I'd love to see an income tax cut. You can't get Democrats to sign off on that. And Republicans ran bills year after year after year to try and do this, going, well, the governor wants this. The governor wants an income tax cut. And the Democrats would go, nah, no, not a starter. Don't.
And why did they sign off this year?
If you want to get the governor to sign off on your family affordability tax credit or some of these other really big ticket tax credits, you got to give a little bit
so
this year.
That
was the vote trade. It's these big tax credits that taps Tabor surplus that Democrats badly wanted, and that was the way to get to the finish line for all of it.
So this gives Polis some tax cut cred.
Yeah.
But only this much, because he again increases how much goes out in fees, or in this case, child care credits.
This family affordability credit, yeah, that's the big one. That's the one that...
And he doesn't call that a fee, does he?
No.
That way it doesn't fall under the limit of Prop 117, which says you can't do more than, I forget, $100 million.
Well, this isn't a fee. Nobody's getting charged for this. This is money that's going out of the Tabor surplus and into the pockets of families with kids under the age of 16.
It's redistribution. These are not the families that paid for the surplus.
You're absolutely correct. And I've had that conversation with the folks running that bill about whether this was redistribution of wealth.
They didn't, what do they say?
They don't like that term.
But it is. But, so most all of our state taxes come from income taxes.
Right.
So the best way to give back is with an income tax cut, so that those people who are paying most of the income tax get most of the refund.
Right. But that's...
This is redistribution.
Yeah. In my mind, it was. But I got pushback. They felt like it was an appropriate use to...
to redistribute.
To cut child poverty. I mean, that's the argument on this particular bill, which is House Bill 1311.
You know, pardon me for getting on my horse. You want to cut child poverty, you get people jobs. People have more money, it provides for more jobs. That's how we take care of children.
You get them jobs where they can pay for their housing and for everything else, and not minimum wage jobs and not jobs that are going to keep them in poverty. There's lots of jobs that will keep people in poverty. We got plenty of those.
So the arrangement was, you give me this little tax cut, I give you half of the refunds for redistribution. That seems like a terrible deal.
It did have a few folks that didn't care for it. It wasn't passed unanimously. So there are some folks who weren't crazy about it, but that is the deal.
And that's that. The question is, this tax cut isn't permanent.
No.
The credits, as Reagan once said, there is nothing closer to immortality than a new government program. What happens to these credits?
Some of them are permanent, some of them are not. The care worker one that I referred to, that's got a sunset date on it.
What is a care worker and what are they getting?
Like a nursing assistant in a nursing home, or a person who's taking care of a loved one at home. Just anybody who's sort of in the home health care or even in nursing homes, as long as you're not a certified nursing assistant. If you're just, you know, if you're not certified, you could qualify for this. So it's people who take care of other people, and it can be in a wide range of venues, for lack of a better word. Now, I don't believe there is a sunset on the family affordability tax credit.
The largest one. Which
the
was,
large one does not.
It's like $700 million a year.
But it does have a caveat that if the money isn't there, either those tax credits are reduced or they go away entirely.
Tax credits never go away.
I'm just telling you what's in the bill, okay?
And what's so funny is that concentrated interests always win diffused interests always lose. Because diffuse interests aren't there fighting at the Capitol. They don't have the same lobbyists. They don't have the same buying power. They don't have the same voice. And it's just criminal that our governor lied to us when he said he was going to reverse a bunch of these credits, reverse a bunch of special interest tax breaks to lower this. Instead, he's increasing it. What a missed opportunity.
There have been times when they have gone after some of these tax breaks. But they're not substantial. It's nothing that you can go back to and say, this cutting this tax break is going to save us, you know, $1 million a year. It just doesn't work that way.
A lot of them, however, are pretty large. And
but those are not the ones they're going after. That's my point.
Exactly. All right, let's talk about affordability in homes. Mm-hmm. Again this year, the trial lawyers trump everybody
on
construction defects. Let me set the ball up for this one. The homes that people can use as starter homes are often condominiums.
Correct.
The problem is that condominiums get sued in this state at an exorbitant rate because there's no defects legislation that says we're gonna keep you covered. You can't sue at this point unless, you know, X amount of people get into the lawsuit. Other states have that, and that's why they have affordable condominiums. We don't. And the reason is because the trial lawyers don't want this, and this has been a problem for a decade or more, and this is the year more than any that I heard leaders saying we need to do something about affordability, including our Speaker of the House, who got a bill to do just that on April 11th, and she sat on it until it died. So she's the one who was there saying we need to do something about affordability for homes for younger families, and she killed it.
The trial lawyers didn't win everything this year, which I know will make you happy, but there were competing construction defects bills. There was one that they opposed that was run by Representative Shannon Byrd, and I want to say Senator Zensinger, I think, was the sponsor in the Senate, or maybe it was Senator Kirkmeyer. I'm tired, can't remember, but that one would have put some guardrails around the construction defects law that they believed would have helped with the liability issue. That's what they're really going after. And that's why condos are so expensive to build, is because the liability insurance is incredibly expensive. It's three times what it should be. So that bill died toward the end of the session. But there was a bill that was backed by the trial lawyers that would have extended the statute of limitations and the statute of repose. These two things that tell a homeowner when they can file a defects claim. That bill also went down in flames. And a study of liability insurance in the condo market also went down in flames. So we got nothing on the condo issue this year. Nothing.
What a shame. What a lost opportunity.
It's sad.
That the Senate, almost a supermajority Democratic Senate, passed a bill on construction defects in the House. They never got a vote on it.
Nope.
Never even went to committee. Mm. And that's the kind of stuff that voters should know about, but they don't. Talk to me about what did pass on homes. So now
lots and lots and lots. Right. The governor's signature bill on homes was on what's called transit-oriented communities. And that got quite a bit of change over the course of its progress through the House and Senate. The idea here is that you want to build as much affordable housing as possible around transit stations, whether it's RTD bus lines.
So it's social engineering. You're not letting it to the market. Incentives or mandates that developers have to do this, this, or this around the government monopoly.
And local governments got mandates too, and they did not like this bill one little bit. They never came off of opposition on it. The interesting thing about this bill is some of the conversations that I've been having with county commissioners. For a lot of counties, this is just not going to work. They don't have the area that they can develop that is near a light rail station or a bus route, or there's something else that gets in the way. In Arapahoe County, it's I-25. Huh. You know, you can't build a a big affordable housing project if I-25 is right in the middle of the only piece of land you've got. The other thing is that this only applies to what's known as metropolitan planning organizations, and there's five of them. So it's basically the Front Range and Grand Junction. That's it. This only applies to suburban and urban settings. Doesn't apply to rural Colorado, which also has affordable housing issues. You want to go find an affordable housing issue, go down to southeastern Colorado, where so many of the homes have got asbestos. Developers won't touch any of that down there. What are they doing to promote development so that people have a place to live down there? Zip.
There's also this push to statewide, like nationalize, statify transit. And so
yes.
they have done everything they can to suck more money into the black hole of RTD and transit. So now we have more fees that'll be coming from oil and gas.
That's
that
right.
Go to
transit.
To transit, not to fix our broken roads where 96% of us ride, but no, just for this tiny little percentage, we're going to keep our gas prices high for you. More and more of this is wrapped around the governor's pipe dream of creating a statewide transit system with the government, state government on the top. Which brings us to this bill, oil and gas. Help me with this one. So another
is
one
that's the fee bill that you're talking about.
Okay. Another one that was sprung late.
Very late.
And had backroom deals, and then all of a sudden there's fees for oil and gas. The big oil and gas companies seem to have done all the work. The locals were pushed out. What does it do?
It charges, it levies another fee on oil and gas production, and the more production, the more money it's going to raise. That money, in turn, gets turned around and put into transit, as you said. And one of the people I talked to about this, Senator Byron Pelton, who's very, very active on these issues, and this perplexed him mightily. He called it extortion.
It is extortion.
It's like, okay, you've been railing against oil and gas for years. You want to reduce the impact of oil and gas in Colorado, and your solution is to charge them more money so you can pay for your transit projects? I thought he had a pretty good point.
Well, there was also some extortion going on that there were some bills to end oil and gas.
Which didn't.
Totally.
Which didn't
and so,
succeed.
Here,
yeah.
With a gun to your head, we can either put you out of business completely, or you can pay a little protection money to transit, and we'll let you keep going for a while.
I think that's where Pelton was going.
Yeah, this was complete protection money racket, mafia style, which is you want to keep pumping your oil and gas? Great. You need to pay us protection money. Otherwise, we've got these bills here that could put you out of business completely.
Bills. You also had ballot measures that were on this topic, too, and that the agreement was to pull those ballot measures.
How do you stop a ballot measure from doing that? Who was behind the ballot measure?
That I don't know. That was not something I
again,
had time
just,
to look into.
It is ugly. It is just ugly that our government puts a gun to any industry's head, particularly the one that employs the most, that adds the most amount of tax revenue to what we have, and says, you want to stay in business, you pay for trolley cars that nobody else wants to pay for. I can tell the push for the Boulder trolley line is getting bad. This was a promise that was made back in 2004 that we'd have this rail line to Longmont. We also seem to forget that a promise was made back in 1972 that we'd have by 1980 118 miles of fixed rail system. That was never even started in earnest.
Yeah.
So not only haven't they finished their promise from 2004 on that, they haven't finished their promise from 1972. An interesting little fact was the 1972 one said, we're going to raise a half penny a dollar sales tax, and we're going to cut it in half in 1980 after the thing is built. That pays for the capital, and the rest pays for the maintenance. A funny thing happened.
Let me guess.
Never
went away.
It went up to 0.6 cents afterwards.
Yeah. Right. But you should be happy because there is a mandate in these transit bills to make sure that end line and that Boulder Boulder
Why would that make me happy? That is the stupidest line in the world. What you need a mandate for is to put services back in poor neighborhoods. What you need is to fix the damn roads and give people who don't have mobility a voucher. Give them money so that they can go on the buses that they want or Uber that they want. You know, I believe that Denver's transit, Colorado's transit, is systematically racist. It takes money from poor people so rich guys can not have to pay parking when they go to a Rockies game. It's ugly, but they want to socially engineer, and they want to put their pack and stack housing by the trolley stops. And instead of the cities deciding that or the towns deciding that, it's Polis and his highway department deciding it.
The other thing with this transit-oriented communities bill is the issue of density. And what I'm hearing is that it is just not workable. The density requirement in this transit bill, the transit-oriented communities bill, is 40 units per acre. There isn't a developer that says that they can do that. 20 is too low. They could go above 20. They might get to 30, 40, not doable. This is going to be really, really interesting once this bill is signed into law to see how this works. The one good thing that came out of this, of the changes that came out of this, according to the local governments in particular, this bill had a heck of a stick in it. It would have allowed the state government to seek court injunctions against any local government that refused to play along. And you'll really like this, they would have been stripped of their state transportation funding.
Well, like they get any road money anyway.
Well, but it would have taken those things away. And the local governments just, they had conniptions about it, but so did legislators in the House, including some House Democrats who said when the bill went over to the Senate, it still had those punitive measures in it. And more than a few who got up and said, I'm voting for this today, but this comes back like this, I will do everything in my power to kill it. They were that furious about that. So when it got over to the Senate, that the first thing that happened is they took those things out, and it lost support from some of the progressive Democrats. You can't win.
Well, I just love, you know, the same people who could not get the job done until the night before, like high school kids on their term paper, are the ones who are designing our cities, are socially engineering our world, and redistributing wealth. They're not even disciplined enough to hold a calendar to get these bills done in 4 months. They have to wait to the last 3 days to do the biggest percentage of them, but yet they're smart enough to know how we're supposed to live on top of each other like rats. There's nothing wrong with pack and stack housing if people want to do that, but to mandate it at gunpoint is reprehensible.
It's also unconstitutional.
Why is it unconstitutional?
Because Colorado's constitution allows local governments that are under this, and it's not all of them, but you have something called home rule. And under home rule, you get to decide issues like zoning, which the transit-oriented communities impacts. That density requirement, that's a zoning requirement. 40 units an acre, that's zoning. That's telling local governments, you have to do this. And the local governments are like, this is the state doing something that's unconstitutional. You can't tell us to do these things.
This is a theme of what's going on in the legislature, which is to federalize, but stateize, as much power as possible. What makes Colorado so powerful, so good, is that our government is close to the people. These are the people you see, your city council members at the grocery store, your county commissioners at the fair.
Sure.
And you don't have to drive down to Denver to say, you know, I'd like the bus route is a little too late. You know what, we're supposed to go to Denver, or do you go to your own RTD representative locally? And we're losing that because power wants to centralize in Denver like it did in Washington, D.C. And it's a shame that it's happening. I find it heartbreaking.
Last year, the governor's signature housing proposal had everything but the kitchen sink in it. On transit-oriented communities, accessory dwelling units, mandates, all that kind of stuff. It died on the last day of session. So this year's solution was to break all those things into little pieces. And we had something like, I think maybe 20 bills that actually came out of last year's. Not all succeeded. Some went by the wayside.
Real quickly, there was also one that says you can't tell how many people can live in your house. The bedrooms are for people. So in Boulder, my where I live, you cannot have four unrelated people living in the same house.
Not no more,
because Boulder's home rule, screw you guys. We know at the state level that you should allow, 38 people in a two-bedroom.
Unless there's a health and safety reason for not doing it, or some other, whatever the conditions might happen to be. Yeah, lots of people are going to be allowed to live together in situations where it wouldn't have happened before.
And what about additional dwelling units, ADUs?
Accessory. Dwelling. Granny flats, tiny homes. These are things, this one is not quite as onerous in terms of the mandates. They just say if you don't allow accessory dwelling units, you should, and these are things that are put on single family
So if I want to put a small house in my backyard.
That's exactly what an accessory dwelling unit is.
And the city doesn't let me. Now will they be forced to let me?
Yeah.
Really? Boulder's not going to like this.
Sorry, Boulder, but yeah. This one had bipartisan support, which I found interesting. It was one of the few really big housing bills that had that kind of support. The transit-oriented community certainly didn't.
Is there any other huge thing that happened? And let me ask you.
In the legislature?
Yeah.
Well, school finance.
What happened?
We have had the same School Finance Act for 30 years. And legislators have been trying for the last 7 years through after session interim committee to come up with a new school finance formula. And they finally gave up on that and went with a task force, because that's how things work, came up with a task force finally, relatively late in the session after the School Finance Act had already been introduced. The speaker came out with a new school finance funding formula. It immediately got a lot of pushback from suburban districts. Jeffco, Douglas County didn't like it. But I will tell you, Republicans and lots of Democrats loved it, because the money is now following the student more than it has in the past. The way the School Finance Act works is that you have a base amount of money per pupil. And then you have all these other different factors that are placed on top of all that. And then at the very tail end, you have money for special ed, English language learners, and low-income students. Well, they're now at the top of the heap. They're going to get funding first.
Low-income students.
Low-income English language learners and special ed students. The factors for them, you still have that base amount per pupil, but then you have the funding that's going to go ostensibly to help these three groups of students. And my big question is, how do you prove it? How do you prove these students are getting that money?
One last question before.
Which I have not gotten what I think is a good answer yet.
Before we wrap it up, the so-called assault weapon bill looked like it was certain to pass, and then it kind of ran out of time. I've got to wonder, how much was it that the governor did not want it on his desk?
100%.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Say a little more about that.
The governor, he's in a funny situation here. When he was in Congress, he actually sponsored an assault weapons ban. But since he's been governor, he has been skeptical, and I think is the word that they've used, that an assault weapons ban is the right path forward for Colorado. And what he has said, and some of the people who are opposed to this bill have said, so all you have to do is get in your car, drive to Wyoming. It's a short drive. Go up there. Go buy the assault weapons that you want. The ban only prohibited the purchase of assault weapons. It didn't attempt to take assault weapons away from people who had already bought them. There's other bills that may have that kind of impact, but the governor, 2 years now, has not wanted this bill on his desk. It got through the House this year and died in a Senate committee, or died before it got to the State Affairs Committee.
Ran out of time.
It did run out of time, but there was, and this is kind of a funny thing, Senator Tom Sullivan, who has been one of the strongest advocates for gun control measures, is also on the governor's side on this issue of not thinking that an assault weapons ban in Colorado would work. Had that bill gone to a vote, it almost certainly would have died. Sullivan would have voted against it.
It's hard for me to imagine that Sullivan would vote against any gun ban.
This may be the one exception.
Interesting. Thank you for keeping up with all this. I know it's been maddening. You need a good nap now. So do reporters go into like a slumber, like a hibernation for the next 3 months? Is that what Capitol reporters do? Grab a bunch of margaritas, go down to Mexico, and you're not heard of for 3 months?
June 25th, the primaries are coming. There is no rest for the wicked.
Marianne, thank you so much.
You are so welcome. Thanks for having me.
If you've enjoyed this episode of Devil's Advocate, I hope you'll share it with a friend, and I hope you'll subscribe and follow the show. We have new ones released weekly. Remember, this audio was taken from our TV show. To watch it, just search the letters IITV for Independence Institute TV on YouTube for this and many other great conversations.